Hello there, and welcome to Beyond the Surface, where the saying to be seen is to be understood comes to life. I want to begin by first honoring the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on. I live and work on Gundungurra land and acknowledge the traditional landowners of my guests near and far. I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions, and cultures of our First Nations people. The land below my feet is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. Beyond the Surface will have periodic bonus episodes, which will serve as foundational information on some of the topics people share in their stories. They will be interesting, informative, and insightful. My hope is that they will not only educate, but also validate the experiences of you, the listener. Having language to describe our experiences is vital for our healing and growth. Today, I am joined by two other therapists working in the religious trauma space. We discuss the Australian TV show Prosper about a fictional megachurch family, exploring the crossovers between fiction and reality, the role of the pastor's wife, love bombing, all while interweaving our own personal experiences also. Please be advised that the episode may contain spoilers. This is Beyond the Surface. Welcome, Jane and Elise. Thanks for joining me.
Oh,
Thank
no
you.
problem.
I am excited about this conversation and excited for all of the wrong reasons, I think. And I know that Elise had already watched this and had has suffered through watching it again. But Jane, I mean, you keep saying that I made you watch it. I'm still like, we have power of choice here. But
Seriously.
we are talking about the TV show on Stan, which is a TV platform in Australia. I don't think it is in the US or overseas. About the TV show Prosper, which stars very famous names of Rebecca Gibney and Richard Roxburgh and things like that. So, very prominent casting. In terms of what Prosper is, Elise, can you just give a quick overview for people who have not seen it? What is the show Prosper all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like you said, Prosper is a series. So, it's 8 episodes and it can be quite a bit to get through all 8 episodes. Essentially, it's about an evangelical megachurch called Ustar that's run by its charismatic founder, Cal Quinn, and his family and a few other people very close to him. It's set in Sydney, Australia. But they are very quickly expanding their church empire into the United States. They're about to plant a church in LA. And clearly, they have world domination kind of in their sights. But behind all of the kind of lights, camera, action, glamour, whatever it might look like on the outside, there's very clearly a dark underbelly to this megachurch. And so through the series, you start to see some of that with the secrets and scandals. There's ambition, power plays, divided loyalties, lots of different things going on. But it kind of picks up at the height of their success or their growth, or so it seems. And that's basically what Prosper's about.
I love the term underbelly. It's like evangelical underbelly, because there is all sorts of drama and death and like secrets and it is a little bit like the church version of underbelly.
It's dirty. It's really,
I mean, and if people don't know the underbelly reference, go and do a quick Google. You'll find a lot of them. Okay, I am gonna start. I'm gonna jump straight to you, Jane, because you are very open about the fact that you were a part of a church quite similar to that is seen in Prosper. And so I'm itching to hear what it was like for you to watch this show.
Oh man, honestly, I had to employ all of my powers of like emotional regulation, every tool I've got in the toolkit to just breathe through it and be okay. Even talking about it now, I can feel my heart rate up and I feel a bit shaky. It's interesting, like this stuff stays with us.
Yeah, I found it like extremely uncomfortable. I think just because there was a lot that was kind of obviously for the creative production of it that was sort of put in place as an artistic representation. I actually think they did quite a good job given what that was. Richard Roxburgh was outstanding. He portrayed that sort of man at the top kind of senior pastor character so well. There was a lot that wasn't quite right, that sort of was close to the mark but wasn't quite there. But yeah, so many themes. Like you touched on so many different themes that were bang on. And I think I was adding it up. I think I spent 25 years in that church from the time I was 13. I had a couple of times where with the same denomination, I was part of church plants and part of similar churches doing other things, but it definitely within that movement for the better part of 30 years. It's all connected in the way that you see in the show. You've got the leaders that have got that kind of Tony Robbins sort of motivational type charisma, the cool factor, the proximity to power. Like there's so much. Even the way they black out the auditorium. We live in Sydney, in one of the most beautiful cities in the world, sun drenched and gorgeous outside, and yet you go inside on a Sunday morning and like everything's dark. It wasn't quite like that in the services, like when they were preaching, the lights were on, you could see the congregation, but it was so similar. I think the part that I found was hard for me is that I knew so many of the senior leaders and their families right from, like, I was there when the church had 100 people in it, in the school hall, and the senior pastors were, packing up the chairs, and it was very much like a family, small community church that had definitely had a big vision, but it grew. It didn't start there from what you see at Ustar, which I think is the most ridiculous name, which I kind of said, yeah. But yeah, so I think I found that part quite uncomfortable. Just sort of, yes, I see all of what it's become, and there's so much grief in that for me and so many others. But I also knew where it started from, a genuine place. They people who really genuinely love God and are committed to community, are committed to church planting, church growth, love of people. And then just over time, it just becomes something else. So yeah.
And I think it goes back to, Elise saying that we sort of tap in and see it at its height of,
Yeah.
and it's at its height of grandiosity and self-entitlement and narcissism, and we forget that that these are real, started out as real people with a passion and a heart, and I think it's really easy to forget that when we see the grandiosity and the narcissism, which is, essentially where Prosper kicks off. We don't see, there is a moment where they're talking about that, a couple of them, I think. Cal and his offsider, who basically hides everything for him, sort of alluded and had a conversation about that, of where they began. But it would have, it would be interesting to see if they continue, whether there is a humanizing aspect that could be brought in. I'm going to skip a few questions, and we'll come back to some of the individual characters in a moment. But there was a lot of conversation publicly about this show, and whether it was accurate, whether it was, particularly from other Christians, I would say, well, I'm not going to watch that because it's just painting an ugly picture of Christianity, and that's not really what it's like. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what it is like to watch dramatized shows of what is actually happening, because we know that the stuff that we're seeing is actually happening in churches around the globe. And then it's not just drama.
No, it's not just drama. I think what, again, the creative sort of expression of it, it sort of highlights a few different things. And you have, you know, the hidden pregnancy, you have the sort of saving face of the church at all costs, literally at all costs, like it doesn't matter. The reputation of the church is upheld at all costs. I think, you know, the conversion practices, you know, that's definitely real and devastating, as you know, in your community. And and even stuff like the cool factor, you know, like that's definitely there, like wanting to be where the kind of cool people are.
Yeah.
And you see that not just in the church that I spent so many years in, but in other mega church movements in Australia and New Zealand and certainly the US, but in our culture, it's real. You know, the pastors with the tight pants and you've got all the hip stuff and the car and the gadgets and all that kind of thing. Even I was talking to you guys before about how I remembered a story which kind of horrified me. It's amazing what comes up when you give it space. I was a youth pastor on a church plant in my early 20s, and I had a flatmate who was a girl who wasn't a Christian. And she brought her boyfriend over one weekend, and I could hear that there was, you know, some things going on in the next room that would not be okay for me and my, you know, very high standards and, you know, the purity culture that I was very much a part of and that I was teaching my young people, God help me. And the next morning after he'd gone, you know, and she'd sort of sewed that up and the whole thing, I was like, yeah, look, I just don't think that, you know, I just can't be associated with that kind of behavior. You know, like I'm a youth pastor, you know, I can't, and with that kind of tone as well, you know, that super condescending sort of, yeah, look, it's just not really, it's just not going to be okay. And so I just think it would be better if, you know, you moved out. And I couldn't afford for her to move out. Like I needed the rental money, but it was my values. It was so important for me to uphold that. And it wasn't even just my values. It was, well, I can't be seen to be connected to someone who's having sex outside of marriage. And there's a scene in one of the episodes where you see these three girls that are living together. And, you know, the doors have to stay open. The boy's not allowed in the room. It's like a whole thing. It just made me twitch. Yeah. So many, I could keep talking, but I won't.
Yeah, and I think we need to be really careful saying things like, well, you know, that's just a bit ridiculous, or, you know, this, you know, it wouldn't really happen that way. Because I think it can be quite dismissive to people that have actually had real trauma occur in spaces like this. And at you know, at the very beginning of realizing that things like that have happened to them, they could be saying that very same thing to themselves, right? Like, oh, am I just being too dramatic? Did I just make it up? And so if we're also saying similar things like that, well, you know, are you sure you're not exaggerating this? I think it can feel very dramatized because you've got all of these scenarios squished into 8 episodes of a show. So it might feel very dramatized, but in my personal and professional experience, all of these events are very real, and the depth of trauma that is experienced in that is very real. So I think I would just gently suggest to people that if that is your automatic reaction, that's fine, but perhaps there's just some more space that can be created to listen to stories and people's experiences that are willing to share them. Because it might feel dramatized, but all of the stories are very real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think if that is someone's default response is to sort of suggest that it's dramatized or ridiculous or over the top, I would also suggest to just get curious as to why that is, because if you are someone who has a faith upbringing or is perhaps currently identifies with a faith, there we have unconscious bias and things like that. And so I think it's easier for us to think that that's dramatized and made up. And I mean, had I watched this show like 5 years ago, even I probably would have said that that was over the top and dramatized and it's not that bad. And so we can only know what we know. But it doesn't mean that we can't get curious about it and look at what are the themes, at least, you know, to separate ourselves from the dramatization that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to say one thing that I think wasn't there
that
was interesting was that there are literally thousands of Bible college students and unpaid volunteers that run around like little busy bees. Like I feel like the family was kind of this kind of group that just, you know, did everything and went everywhere together. And I think a lot of that's probably true in different circles. But there's always a person. And I thought Taz's character was interesting because she always had the coffee. She always knew what was coming next. She was there. She was ready. But there are drivers. There are people setting stuff up. There are people hovering at all times. There's makeup people. There's cleaners. There's people organizing food. And I guess, you know, maybe budgets don't extend to larger kind of crowds or extras or whatever. But that's one thing that does seem to follow mega church people, and even you see it in much smaller churches as well, because they're trying to emulate the same kind of formula. All of the senior people have minders, fixers, people that will just get stuff done, usually unpaid, usually quite exploitative. And so I kind of noticed that. I'm thinking there's no way he'd be doing that. There's no way she'd be doing that. Someone else would be doing that for them. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. That was quite visually interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it certainly missed the mark on highlighting the exploitation that happens in a vast not just big mega churches, but that, like you said, that's happening on a smaller scale as well. And there might not be makeup teams, but it doesn't mean that there still aren't volunteer teams where there is masses amounts of unpaid labor that's happening and a lot of the time happening because people feel guilted into it, and they're also supposed to be happy about it because they're doing it for the Lord, so they're not even allowed to feel exhausted by it.
I get to do this.
Absolutely.
Oh goodness, I've seen that in posters in hallways for a long time.
Yeah, and I think this conversation is going to be really interesting because both you, Jane and Elise, have similar church backgrounds in terms of both quite large churches, evangelical churches or Pentecostal in our area. And I come from the polar opposite of that. So I'm seeing these themes pop up, and they are still relevant to the small church that only has, you know, 100, 120 people in it at most, to the churches that have tens of thousands of people. And so for those who go, oh, well, I'm just from, you know, a small Baptist or like a little Anglican church or whatever it is, to not assume that just because we're not a large Pentecostal church that harm isn't happening and that these sorts of things can still be happening in those environments. Now I'm going to skip over Cal for a minute because he's like obviously the pastor and the main guy. But I remember you mentioning something about Abby. And so Abby was Cal's wife. She's the pastor's wife. And I remember you mentioning Jane in one of the comments that you said, and I could not agree more with you, which is that she's not warm enough. Right? So the pastor's wife often plays a very particular role in the church. And as much as I adore Rebecca Gibney as an actress, she's incredible. She's not warm enough, right?
Yeah. No, I feel like the all of the sort of senior pastors' wives or any pastors' wives, I was really also disappointed that the term smoking hot didn't come up.
Yes.
At any point. I was waiting for a smoking hot wife. Maybe, you know, one of the younger ones might have brought that up at some point, but sadly, no. Missed opportunity. But yeah, I think the pastor's wives are beautiful. Like, they are warm. They are genuine. They're interested. They're, you know, they're authentic. They are friendly. They're, to me, it was just a very kind of a, she was quite cold, I thought, in, you know, compared to my experience of those women. It also made me think about Kate Bowler, is a Pentecostal historian. And she's Canadian. She's so good. And she's got a book called The Preacher's Wife. And she actually did a massive deep dive into pastors' wives in Pentecostal spaces and how they basically are running everything. And they, as we saw with Abby, she is she's protecting the man of God at every turn. She's doing all the sort of, you know, holding of everything together. But yeah, but doesn't also mean that she can't be quite manipulative in that and justify things that are, you know, unjustifiable. But yeah, but Kate Bowler's book is really interesting because it also shows how in the different models of church that we have, like complementarianism, you know, she's there to come alongside and help, like that help meet sort of gross language. Whereas often she's very powerful in her own right. Yet that, yes, we're here as a couple doing this thing together, but it, you don't often see the woman able to sort of be a leader and be powerful in her own right. And so it just made me think of that research as well, which is interesting. But yeah, but with Abby, I just thought, no, she's too cold and calculated. Yeah.
Even the haircut, like everything about her, like she looked like a business, she looked like a businesswoman. Yeah. That's my first thought was she looks like a boss. And she's not the boss. She might be acting like the boss in terms of, like you said, sort of making sure that everything is being held together. But I'm curious, Elise, because there's a large conversation around, is Abby just as bad as Cal? Is she a victim? Is, like, who is she in this conversation?
Yeah, gosh, I've sat with this one for such a long time going, I don't know. I'm not sure. And I think that comes from the fact that we don't see where she came from.
Yeah.
We don't see what's happened. We don't see how she's got to this position. But you also can't deny that the things that she's not just doing but pardoning or covering over, like you said, for Cal, who everyone is just scrambling to make sure that he's happy all the time. And so we also see that she's made decisions, like with her, you know, 15-year-old daughter who gets pregnant, who she then sends away. But not only that, we hear, you know, the words that she's said to her daughter when she sends her away. And that potentially that's also covering for Cal as well. But yeah, there's so much that you can't excuse, even if we know where she's come from and what's happened and how she's got to this position. So yeah, I'm just sitting not in the middle, but going, there's so much you can't excuse, but I wish we had more of the backstory.
Yeah, it's a really nuanced conversation, I think. And I don't think that there is a clear answer. And I've seen a lot of people asking the question online is, you know, was Abby like a perpetrator or a victim in this scenario? And I think she is both. I think that is an important conversation, that actually you can be both in that scenario, because like you said, regardless of her history or the context or the background, there are harmful things that she is doing. And enabling, and that can't be excused either. Yeah, but I think it's a hard, I don't think that there is, I mean, and this is going to harp back to the fact that we like things when they fit in a box and black and white and, good or bad. I think Abby does not fit in a box in terms of, like, in terms of whether she is just as bad as Cal or whether she is the victim of Cal. I don't think that that's a clear-cut conversation. But she is certainly a very interesting character. And it would
I wanted more love bombing from her. I wanted
yes.
more, oh my gosh, hi, it's so great to see you.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, church, we love you. Like, I kind of wanted more of that sort of, yeah, I wanted more, I guess warmth is the word, but mm-hmm. also that kind of, there's almost like a saccharine sweetness that comes mm-hmm. with it at times as well.
Yeah.
And everything's just so great and God is good. And like, it's just mm-hmm. that whole kind of big, big love energy that you see yeah. from a lot of these women. And mm-hmm. I felt like that kind of missed the mark. I also feel like of any of the women, not just in the church I grew up with, but in other churches I know as well, I would struggle of what I know of them. I would struggle to imagine that they would send a daughter away who was pregnant. I don't know that, like, I feel like the, and I'm sure that it has happened and happens, but then of the women that I know, I feel like that sort of situation would be turned around for God's glory.
Yeah,
like I feel like it glory. Would be, yes, like I feel like it would be something that they would just kind of struggle with at first, mm-hmm. but then own it and turn it around and try to actually make it work for them. Like, yeah, I can't imagine that they would have actually sent her away, but I mean, maybe I'm wrong there, but mm. yeah, that was an interesting one.
Yeah, I would agree. In the same way that we saw him, like Cal, use their son's accident as, you know, a miracle story and a redemption
yeah.
story,
yes.
I would have expected, you know, this is a test from the Lord and, you know, using it as a, I mean, we know that churches love redemption stories. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would have imagined it pitched. The biggest thing about Abby for me was that she didn't have the voice.
Yeah.
To me, a preacher, like a pastor's wife, particularly mega churches, like if you think about like quite prominent ones around the world, they all have a voice, like it's a very particular style of voice. And I don't, you know, we saw a very mild attempt of love bombing between from Abby to Juno, but even that was. It was still, it was pretty clinical love bombing, if we, you know, use that term. It was not, you know, overly excessive. And she almost tasked the love bombing to somebody else,
yeah.
her daughter-in-law. Whereas there was, yeah, I think warmth is the only other thing. But also, like, excessive warmth, like over the
yeah,
top.
Over
like,
the top.
Like sickly warm, yeah. And joyous, that was missing. I'm wondering where we're throwing around the term love bombing, but there are probably people who maybe don't know what that means. So I'm wondering whether, I mean, perhaps Elise, you can explain what love bombing is.
Yeah. And this conversation is really interesting because I did find that some of the love bombing, like you said, was outsourced.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. And I think, so essentially, love bombing is a form of psychological and emotional abuse that employs really manipulative tactics, generally at the start of a relationship or a friendship, to really shower someone with affection, admiration, really intense emotions in order to try and gain control and power over them. So they can do that through excessive flattery, lots of gift giving, lots of attention. So over communicating, that could be through text messages, phone calls, dropping in at someone's house, which we see really over the top gestures. But it can also be not taking no for an answer, or getting upset when boundaries are tried to put in place. And then essentially deciding who you can and can't talk to, who is going to be good for you to have communication with and who's not. And it will generally just be them. And so, again, it's used to try and gain trust really quickly, but also really deeply to get people to deeply trust in either a person, or I've seen this done through organizations like a church. ultimately creating this environment where victims feel like they're trapped and they feel very indebted to the person or the organization. So even if they begin to feel uncomfortable or unsafe, it's really hard to find a way out. And that's, yeah, that's essentially what love bombing is, but the way that can be done can be all different ways.
Yeah. And I'm not actually entirely sure that the show does love bombing all that well, and doesn't necessarily show the tactics and what it actually looks like in a very real way, because you know, the only person we really see that happening with is Juno, and that very quick starting out as very skeptical, very questioning, very almost critical of the church, and then gets sort of like brought into the fold a little bit, and it was a very quick transformation, I feel like, a little too quick for my liking. I'm not sure that it happens that quickly in reality. I think it probably can, but not to the point where, you know, she's finding out some really horrific things about the connection between Cal and her mother's death, and is still kicking around and still, like, you know, and we do know that we make excuses for the harm that happens. But there is a really, really quick turnaround in Juno's character, I think, that is not as realistic as what it could have been.
I think it's not usually that quick, but I have definitely had firsthand experience of seeing it happen that quickly. And I think we see this with Juno, because essentially she ends up having a job that is connected to the church and having her housing that's connected with the church. And that happens really quickly because she's in such a vulnerable place of losing her job, losing her house, being kicked out of where she's living. And so the church shows up very quickly as her savior to provide her with a job where it's owned by someone from the church, a house that's cheap where it's owned from someone from the church. And there's this one scene where she moves into this house with a couple of young ladies from the church. And, you know, she just says, yeah, if there's anything I can ever do for you, and that's it. You then see her starting to spend all of her private time or her recreational time outside of work that's connected to the church, now being volunteering for the church, because this is essentially how she's told that she's going to pay it forward, or pay it back. And so I feel like she's put very quickly in a position where now her livelihood, a house over her head, and also her belonging is now connected to the church, because her mum's just died. She has no one. And so I think there are situations like that where it can make a little bit more sense that it can happen a lot quicker than what it typically would with something like love bombing.
Yeah. And I think there is the additional factor of, like, there is a romantic relationship that also builds for Juno with Jed, who is, and I have a visceral reaction every time it was, he was called the prodigal son. And anybody who has read my ebook will know why. But it, like, that romantic and intimate connection that she builds with him also is just another layer of connection that she has, not just to the church, but to the Quinn family. And you know, there is that indebted gratitude almost that she is experiencing. She's a really interesting character. I think she's one of, I think, the most interesting characters in the show.
It's like Gabor Mate says, you trade authenticity for belonging.
Yeah.
You know, and so you just, particularly someone in her situation, you're willing to just do whatever you need to do, like, to be able to just be part of something and to be safe, whether that's actually, you know, roof over your head or money coming in or whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I guess we better talk about the elephant in the room, which is Cal Quinn.
And I agree, Jane. I think this casting was probably the best of the bunch, because we often will equate people who perpetuate harm as monsters. And we know that that is not the case. They are often very charming and enticing, and often even quite physically and like aesthetically pleasing, in terms like they can be good looking and things like that. And I think Richard plays Cal exceptionally well. I think if they got anybody as close as possible, they did pretty good with Cal Quinn.
In Australia, you've got obviously Brian Houston, then you've got Chris Pringle.
Yeah.
And then you've got so Christian City Church and Hillsong. And then you've got I can think of other kind of smaller offshoots and different denominations that have the similar sort of it's almost like a franchise. And then in New Zealand, you've got Arise Church and other kind of bigger churches where, and that, I feel like that character was a really interesting kind of combination of all of them. I think the anger I found really difficult. I know, like in proximity to some of the inner circles and some of these leaders, I know that there's definitely anger and abuse there. I don't know that the way it was portrayed, it would have been as public as that. And it kind of reminded me a little bit more of in the US, you've got Mark Driscoll. So he is just out of control. He is just everything toxic masculinity. And I think that the way that he comes across, it sort of reminded me a little bit of the way, you know, that of what we know about him and his abuse. But yeah, but I found Cal Quinn and a really interesting kind of combination of a whole lot of all of them. And I think also the genuineness, like you see all of the characters, there's a genuine faith there. There's a lot of sort of delusion as well, but you know, like there's a genuine faith. They're going to God for their source, you know, like they're kind of thinking that everything they're doing is for God, for the cause. And they're driven in that way as well, and defined by success. And then when you get to the point of having the kind of power that Cal Quinn has, not just financial but reputational, and his, you know, his good standing with parliamentary, you know, ministers and other influential people, musicians, sports people, whatever. Once they have that, it's a lot to lose. So to even kind of retreat from some of their positioning a little bit is very threatening. Like they'll lose a lot of that stuff really quickly. So yeah, I found that quite interesting. I think he did an amazing job, and I think the way that character was framed was pretty bang on.
I wonder, often I had the concept in my head of we know that these church leaders are not all bad. They're not, you know, the people who are front and center are not always 100% truly awful humans. I think it's easy to think that they are, but they're not. And so I often found myself sort of ruminating on the thought of, at what point does care and concern and compassion and empathy and a heart for God, so to speak, become power, control, manipulation? And I mean, we are yet to even talk about the fact that the show is called Prosper, and it's called Prosper for a reason. And so where does that line draw? Like, where do we draw that line? And how do we notice that in our own leaders if we are still in churches? Because
that's a great question.
Really, really difficult, right?
I also said Chris Pringle before when I meant Phil Pringle.
Phil Pringle, yes.
Chris is his wife. It's just occurred to me. And I think that, I mean, at least you jump in as well, but I think that that's a really interesting one in terms of power. Like, I think, because as I said, I was there when there was 100 people in a school hall, and I watched it even as a teenager. I could see the shift, and you could see that that connection, the affiliation with the US prosperity gospel. You could see all of that influence coming in, and the friends that they were deliberately, you know, connecting themselves to, the people whose churches they were being invited into, and the influence. And it's all about, oh, we want the influence to spread, because the larger the church, you know, the more people that are coming to Christ, you know, all of that stuff. And so it's justified by influence and by God's favor. And yet you see lifestyles changing very quickly. You see power dynamics shifting very quickly. You see very small amount of people becoming quite wealthy at the expense and being propped up by those, you know, busy bee volunteers that I had mentioned before. And you see this false economy, you know, where there's a lot of wealth but being held up by sort of unrealistic, exploitative, in a lot of cases, standards. And then there's a lot of fallout and a lot of pain from that. And so I think wherever there are, you know, different standards for the person on the platform to the person at the door ushering and greeting people as they walk in, you know, where there's that power differential, when you start to see that, I think that there's questions that need to be asked. When there is caginess about financial transparency, when there's things that are happening to people that are being covered up that are just not okay. I was thinking about that church plant that I mentioned, where I was the youth pastor and the worship leader, bless. And I remember there was some pretty awful shit that happened there during that time, towards the end of my time there. And I was only 25, and I was newly married. I had a new baby. And we made the decision to leave and go back to Sydney and go back to, I call it the mothership, but, you know, to the original church that I'd grown up in, that this church plant was an offshoot of. And they welcomed me back. The leadership wanted to know my story, because the stuff that had happened was a church still in that denomination. So they wanted to know. There was an investigation that was done. There was lots of questions that were asked. But at the end of the day, they kept saying to me, literally with fingers to their mouths, shh, like, don't talk about it. So I had no way to process it. I wasn't allowed to speak about it. I had to protect the reputation of the church. And then literally the lead pastor that was part of the state executive at the time, I remember about 6 months after it all happened and we were back in Sydney, I remember thinking, this is before sort of the internet and social media and everything. And so I had no way of finding out what had happened, what the result of the investigation was. And I called him, and he basically told me I was out of line to even ask. And then at the end of it, he said, well, look, people spoke out of turn and we've chosen to stand by our man. And I just went, right. I felt like someone had punched me in the guts. But it's that kind of shit that you just think, when things are being covered over, when justice is not seen to be done, when processes are not followed, and when the reputation of the church is more important than the welfare of people, particularly vulnerable people, that's where we have a problem.
Yeah, I think all of that is... it's just so unhealthy and traumatizing. Something that I would suggest that leaders can reflect on this, people that are choosing to stay can reflect on it, those who are leaving can reflect on it. But something it keeps coming back to for me is, you're asking, where is that line? Like, where do you figure out that they've crossed that line? And for me, one of those ways is, as soon as leadership and potentially the congregation as a whole are okay with hurt people leaving through the back door, as long as you have more people coming in the front door, then we're you know, then that's okay. We
Bingo.
Won't worry about all the ones leaving. And there was a quote from Dion, so the oldest son in this series, that I literally just had to pause it and sit with it for a bit. I thought, this is so much of where all of the issues stem from. And he simply said, what's good for the church is good for us all. But the church was for them something that has to grow, it has to look good, it has to be pulling in the money. It can't have anything negative said about it. So essentially, whenever the organization becomes more important than the people, they've crossed the line. When they're willing to let people be harmed so that the organization doesn't need to be harmed, they've lost it.
Yeah, I think it's when places that should be rooted in humanity lose the humanity.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
I will often say, I mean, and this is more of a reflection thing, but I will often say if there is a part of you that is considering whether somebody is crossing the line, that's enough to look at it. Right? That's enough. You know, there doesn't need to be masses of thoughts afterwards. But if there is a part of you that is concerned or considering that maybe somebody has crossed a line, then that's enough to reflect and to look. Dion was a really interesting
Poor
character.
Dion.
Oh my goodness. It was so Dion is the only character that for me there is a scene in one of the episodes where I am and sitting on the couch most of the time trying to like analyze this, thinking like this is going to make really, really great freaking content. but there is a scene for Dion where it broke my heart. It like, and as a queer person, I could see it coming a mile away from the very first episode. Just the level of suppression and masking that was happening for him. But the scene that I'm talking about is where he kisses another male and he is essentially so overwhelmed and almost traumatized by what happened that he comes running out of that space, just gasping for air and sobbing, and I'm sitting on the couch sobbing because my heart is breaking for this person. Because, again, just because you might be perpetuating harm doesn't mean that you weren't also the victim of harm. And to then find out that, he was sent away for conversion practices, and that he had his dad actively tell him to suppress that part of who he is, broke my heart. I could not at that point feel anything other than just empathy and compassion for Dion. It just, yeah, it was,
Devastating.
yeah, it was. And I think people who, there was an undercurrent of people who, recently, there was the conversion practices ban in New South Wales, and there was a lot of people saying, like, why can't they focus on more important things like the budget and all of this other things in politics? And I would tell those people to sit where Dion is sitting, yeah, because conversion practices are killing people. And it is, I can't even bring myself to use the term conversion therapy because it's not therapy, it's abuse. It was probably my only moment watching those 8 episodes where the only thing I was feeling at that moment was just heartbreak for him and for the experiences and the childhood that he had endured to get to that point.
Yeah, that was rough.
Now I'm gonna go from something really heavy to something really humorous, because I don't think we can do this episode without talking about the ridiculousness of how that episode that series finished, of Cal literally pulling up in the middle of nowhere, putting all of like leaving all of his belongings in his car and walking into the wilderness as if we are supposed to be watching this screen thinking that Cal is Jesus somehow, going into the wilderness to, you know, deal with the temptation and the struggle and things like that. And we have to talk about the just ludicrousy of that imagery.
I think it's a 40-day comeback.
That's right.
Yeah. I expect him to be there for 40 days and 40 nights.
Just the grandiosity and the sense of self-importance, the way that the drama, the way that the world revolves around them. I think it was kind of it was pretty funny in terms of how over the top it was. But at the same time, it's not like if you see the way that some of these pastors act on social media, you know, like the sense of self-importance and the way they center themselves and are so defensive and very rarely accountable. Like I even found his whole thing that preceded that dramatic ending, like the standing up at the table and
like the last
confessing
supper.
All of his sins and saying, telling everyone, and like you just think. It also reminded me of where he was doing those reflection sessions that were recorded. Oh my gosh. But like, not only is that just so unethical on so many levels, but the fact that pastors counsel people without any training in counseling, like you just, oh my gosh. Anyway, so trauma-informed is just not a thing. But the way that he stood up and just exposed everybody's secrets at the dinner table, not just the things he was responsible for, you just think, man, these guys, it's usually guys, you know, the way they carry themselves in the world is, I thought it was perfect the way that it ended because it just represents that grandiosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can think it looks ridiculous that, you know, he's just walking off now on his own, you know. The whole season, he was just talking about, yes, he mentioned the word sin, but it was always in reference to, I was just weak, I had a weak moment, gave into temptation. There was never any acknowledgement that what he did was abusive or harmful. It was still, like you said, it was all about him all the time. So the ending of him just walking off on his own, I feel like it sets up a very interesting season two.
Yeah, it certainly does.
I don't know if I can go for the season two.
I mean, and there are a lot of things that we have not even touched on in terms of, you know, there are multiple children, there are multiple issues. I reckon we could have a whole episode on Jed, but there is a lot there. And I think the walking into the wilderness and the gross conversation around the table, it all stemmed from in the very first episode. And I went to double check because I made a note of it. He literally says, "I must be worth it," and so it sets that tone that Cal is not just the pastor of this church, that Cal must be the essence of God in this church, and I must be worth it. And it sets up that tone of, regardless of what Cal does or doesn't do, that there is no responsibility. There is that overarching sense of entitlement and grandiosity, and that not just I am a vessel for God, but I am the essence of God. And that's a really, really dangerous place for a human to be in, to think that they are that for masses amounts of people, and essentially will do anything, literally anything, to ensure that people never change their mind about that.
He says at one point, "I am this church."
Yes. Yeah, he does.
Where I think Abby challenges him on something and he's like, "I am this church."
Yeah.
And they all recognize that. And I think that that's one thing that I think in Australia we sort of refer to them as sort of mainline churches. But, you know, Uniting Church, Anglican, Baptist, whatever, they have convention and governance around how things work. Like you only have leadership in place for a certain amount of years. There's voting, there's kind of boards, there's eldership, there's council, there's people that sort of have oversight of, you know, many people that have oversight over decisions that are made, the direction of the church. Whereas you see in these mega churches, it's all about the guy at the top and his smoking hot wife. So it's that in itself is so dangerous and so unaccountable.
Yeah.
So I think that is a massive red flag just right there.
Yeah. And I think there's just so, I'm just literally like going through the series in my head and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's so many other things that we could talk about. And I mean, maybe we do a part two, because the conversation of the way that they approached mental health and addiction, and there is a whole conversation around Benji. And I mean, he makes my blood boil, that type of person, and that character, and the way that they utilized celebrity status and things like that to, you know, create notoriety and that sort of thing. And so I think that there's just so many different themes that come up. But I think for people who are watching it to look past the fact that it's an 8-part series on Stan and to go, this is happening on some level in the churches in our community. And there are people who are being actively harmed by what's happening and the way that it's playing out. Because, yeah, and I think to sort of just circle back to where we started, which was that yes, it might be dramatized, but it doesn't mean that there's not reality in that drama. I mean, if we can convince Jane to watch season two when it comes out, maybe we'll do a season two of Prosper, because I'm sure it's yet to come. But yeah, I think the themes and the character traits and the personality traits are the things that's the important part of that show is what is in the show that's actually happening as well. So, and I love having these conversations that are not black and white and really nuanced, and there's no clear-cut answer and that are based on lived experience also. You know, everybody to some degree between the three of us have lived parts of what we just saw on screen or have felt and related to parts of what we were watching, and that's confronting. And
certainly seen them in the counseling room.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a really, that can be confronting. So for anybody who has come from this environment, don't watch it if you are not ready to watch it, or if you don't have good support and good grounding skills. Like, you know, we are all very aware of what triggers us and ways to self-soothe and all of that. And yet it still triggers us and it still causes a physical and a somatic reaction in us. And so just because it's there doesn't mean that you have to watch it. So self-protection is much more important than being a part of that conversation. If you are not ready. So thank you both. I might somehow convince you guys to do a part two that we can talk about all of the things that we didn't talk about.
Some spin-off themes.
Yeah, because I think there is there's an ongoing conversation. Yeah, and there's so many areas that we didn't even touch on. We sort of just skimmed the surface on the main people that are front and center, but there's a lot of things that are happening for the people who are not front and center also. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Surface. Until next time, take care, stay true to who you are, and remember, your voice and your story matters always.